Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World webinar on Friday, the 24th of July, 2020. And I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Slater, Chairman and Chief Investment Officer at Slater Investments. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Great pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about growing up with your father and his influence on your career? Did you grow up talking about investments and business, and did you always want to work in the investment industry?
It's a good question. I mean, I'm one of four, and I'm the only one of those four who found investment interesting. My father really didn't push it, actually. When I was in my early teens, maybe 14, I was very keen to learn more, and he was very reluctant to push that at all. He was almost off-putting, but so he didn't push it. But he did talk a lot about business and what he was doing, which was investment related, and I always found that very interesting. So I think that had a very big impact through osmosis. And then as time went on, when I left university, I read a lot of investment books, and he then started to write the Zulu Principle, which I did a lot of research on, which was hugely helpful to me as well. So he was very, very influential in terms of my thinking, and particularly in terms of my interest.
And how did Slater Investments come about, and how did it evolve into the funds and what it is today?
Well, I started out as a financial journalist. I actually very briefly worked at an investment bank, which I didn't like very much. Then I became a financial journalist for a couple of years, which was a great training because I got to know most of the companies in the market through that. And I was investing my own money at the time. And at a certain point, I had my track record audited, and I was able to use that to attract a couple of small clients, which was sufficient to apply for regulatory status. So I started the business then in 1994. We have always focused on growth businesses. That's been our bread and butter since then. So the funds we run today, not all of them have that length of track record. We have one or two clients who go back a very long way. But the process we follow on the growth side has barely changed in all those years.
How do you judge the performance of the different funds?
Well, yeah, I mean, the key for us is we have a benchmark, which is normally either our peer group or the relevant index, or combination of the two, and we always want to beat those. I think in terms of how I think about things generally, we're looking for double-digit returns. I mean, that's what we're hoping for. Equities over sort of 200 years have returned, I think it's 7%, something like that. And we're hoping to do, double-digit. Some years you can make 30, 40%. Some years it's very hard to make money at all. But when we look at a company, we're looking normally to make 50 to 100% over 3 to 5 years. That's broadly what we're hoping for any company that we're likely to own. It doesn't always work out that way, but that's broadly how we're thinking. So quite significant returns compared with, less risky investments.
What returns do you think is reasonable for a retail investor investing their own money in equities to achieve over time?
Well, I think there are two parts to this. I mean, I think that one is sort of cautionary, which is that I think a private investor should recognize that there are periods where you really can't make money, where it's just really hard, and you can get in terrible trouble if you try too hard. If you try and make things fit that will never fit, you end up very often veering into areas you don't understand and losing a lot of money. So one has to accept there are times when any approach is out of sync with what's happening in the market. And when that's the case, you accept it and you look forward to a time when that will change, which it will. But with that caveat, I would say it's mainly good news for private investors. A private investor has a significant advantage in that they're much more nimble. They're investing less money. That means they can get in and out of situations much more cheaply. There's less frictional cost. But more than that, they're able to focus their investments much more. So they're able to invest in maybe their best five, their best 10 ideas. And a concentrated portfolio like that, which I would advocate if I were advising a private investor who's prepared to put in the time, that's a big caveat, but if they're prepared to put in the time, a concentrated portfolio should do much better than a more diversified fund type portfolio.
And over time, what sort of performance do you think that would yield?
I would think, it depends on the level of effort someone's prepared to put in, but if they're working hard, they should be looking at doubling, at least, I think, what fund type investors are able to do.
So who were the biggest investor influencers for your father? And are they the same people that influenced yourself?
I mean, my father came to investment a completely different way to me. So he came at it via industry, where he'd been working for a long time. And he treated it a bit like a game, in the sense that he found this new game and he tried to work out what it was that made it tick. And so he wasn't really looking to any particular investor. There probably, at the time he was doing that, there weren't any. The UK press was not writing about well-known investors of the past. There was none of that going on. He didn't really have that in his formative phase. There was none of that. Whereas I had a very big choice. There were a lot of books published about investment when I was at sort of university age. There were hundreds of them. There are even more today. I would say the biggest influences on me have been, well, by far the biggest, I think, has been Warren Buffett, in terms of how to think about companies, as businesses, how to think about investment philosophically. In other words, having a sensible methodology and sticking with it, being comfortable not to speculate. So I think he's been, a lot of what Warren Buffett writes, it's about a way of thinking in addition to a methodology. So he was hugely influential. Peter Lynch was very influential. He's written nothing like as much, but he wrote a couple of very good books, which I found very, very, they were very accessible when I first read them. And he really touched on the peg. He didn't call it the peg, but he touched on that in a way in his first book. And that was the first time I'd seen that written. But my father as well was very important. And when when he wrote The Zulu Principle, I was very heavily involved in that process. It was hugely influential on me, because in order to write it, we had to think, we had to ask the question, what do we really think? Which is a hard question to answer in all cases. And my father took that responsibility very seriously. And it really made him, and I think, hard, and we debated a lot of things. So that, again, was a very, very useful process.
And with COVID-19, were you expecting in January what happened in March? And did you sell anything before March? And from March onwards, have you been buying or selling?
Well, we in January, we were wondering why there wasn't a bigger price impact on Western markets, not because we joined all the dots. We didn't expect what happened in Asia to come here. I think probably like most governments, whereas most Asian countries had had that fire drill four or five times with SARS or those sorts of things, they never actually spread west. So that was unexpected for me. But we were focused on the impact on supply chains in China, on Chinese demand, and we still thought that should have a big impact on markets. So we were looking at it from that point of view in January. By the time we realized it was coming our way, obviously there was already a significant price impact that was unfolding quite quickly. And so then our first order of business was to look at survivability, you know, just the degree to which we might be exposed to companies which may not survive. And we were comfortable pretty quickly that our companies would survive in all cases, even in those cases which are, you know, in the gun sights of COVID-19. I don't think we're exposed to failure risk. And of course, as time has gone on, it's become harder for public companies to fail because of the massive efforts by government. And now you've got also very easy access to bank and equity finance as well, which have really completely changed the landscape for companies quoted, certainly in this country, but in most countries.
Did you sell anything because you thought the investment story had changed too much?
No, is the short answer. We sold one or two things in January when we thought there should have been a bigger price impact. So we did do that. But since things really hit in February, March, we haven't sold any positions related to COVID-19. We haven't got that many companies that are directly exposed, that are badly exposed, but we do have a handful. And we're in most of those cases, I think we will run them through this difficult period and over the other side of the valley. It's possible if one or two get to certain price levels, we might move on. We're pretty happy with what we've got, broadly speaking.
And what you were selling in January and maybe February, were they, you were top slicing, or were you actually getting out of positions altogether?
I mean, our activity in January was partly top slicing one or two things. We exited one or two companies as well. But that was really price related. It wasn't because of we weren't looking at COVID-19. It was purely price.
And can you say what you've completely got out of?
We sold out of our holding in Hollywood Bowl,
yes,
which is a very good business.
Yes.
But we've since bought some shares in that at a much lower, they fell very, very sharply. But they were priced sort of very aggressively back in January. I can remember that one. There may be one or two others, but there wasn't a lot. We weren't selling aggressively.
And were there any that you bought into because you thought that COVID could actually beneficially affect them?
We have bought a number of companies this year. We've added, I think, five new names to the portfolio. And they're really a mixture of different types of companies. One or two are companies which are very directly affected, but where there was a very big price impact. One or two are companies where it isn't as clear cut. But, so the way we've looked at things is we've sort of divided our portfolio into three chunks, effectively. There's one chunk, which is about a third, which is made up of companies which we think are either not affected or they're very barely affected or they may be benefiting a bit. And then there's a slightly bigger chunk that's made up of companies where there is an impact, but it's clearly temporary. And then there's a small chunk, maybe 12%, that kind of thing, which is companies which are directly affected. In other words, they've been closed there's very obvious impact from what's happening. And then it's a much more complex analysis. But we're prepared to buy in any of those categories. It's really a question of business quality and price. One of the challenges of COVID-19 is, unlike any other period of market turmoil, is that there's no sort of moral dimension. Normally, in 08 and in every other crisis, the businesses that get in trouble are normally the ones where the management have done something stupid. They've done an acquisition at the top of the market. They've taken on too much debt, those sorts of things. Whereas with COVID, a very good business in normal circumstances can just be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It can just be the wrong type of business for that moment. And our view is that if we can be satisfied that people will go back to their old habits within a reasonable time frame, then we're prepared to look at it. You know, now there are some businesses that have clearly been made worse than by COVID-19. You know, retail being the most obvious example. You know, high street retail, and those are areas where we weren't interested before, and we're even less interested now. So, but there are still plenty of companies that are affected that are basically really good businesses. So we're really looking at things in all of those categories. We're not just choosing looking at COVID winners.
And what sort of cash levels did you have in, say, February compared to your cash levels now?
Our cash levels were quite high, about 20% in February, which is unusually high. They're now sort of 15-16%, so they've come down a little bit. We've been nibbling away, you know, steadily.
And is that through placings, or is that through just buying large positions as they came available?
It's both. So I mean, quite a lot of companies are doing placings at the moment. It's become, you know, for a stockbroker, it's the easiest sales pitch in history now, where they ring up a board and they say, everyone else is doing it, why don't you issue 20% of your share capital? PS, will take a £10 million fee for nothing. And it's very hard for a board to be advised to be prudent and to say no. So there's a lot of that going on. And because there's so much money around, companies are able to issue shares and place large quantities very, very easily at the moment. Some of the things we've done are placings, and some are just buying in the market.
And what's your sense of the wider mood of institutions? How invested are they? And is there a lot of cash on the sidelines waiting for a home? And is it going into equities, or is it going into other asset classes?
I would say there's still a fairly elevated level of cash institutionally, globally. You know, the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, do a survey they've been doing for years. And at the peak of the COVID period, that showed the highest cash level, I think, ever. That's come down quite a bit since then, but it's still slightly elevated, but it's more in the normal range than it was. Our experience is that, what we're told by brokers is that quite a lot more fund managers now, in order to buy something, they've got to sell something. So I think cash levels generally are down quite a lot on what they were, but I would still say they're higher than usual. That's my instinct. On our own, based on my experience, you know, it's the first crisis where we had inflows every day. So back in March, we had inflows every day. We've never had that before. That was a very strange thing. And we haven't had inflows every single day this year, but broadly in the height of the crisis, we were seeing inflows, which I would never have anticipated. I think there is still a fair amount of cash around. In the UK space, the data is that people put money into the UK market in March, April, May, and they took some of that out in June. That's the industry data. But so broadly speaking, I think it makes sense. You know, there is cash around. It was already there before all this started. Interest rates are now nailed to the floor. And as a result of that, cash is being devalued. You can see it. The most obvious expression of it is the performance of gold in relation to all currencies. And gold is doing very, very well. In other words, money is being devalued. That's another way of looking at that. You see it in the money supply data. You see it everywhere. So, you know, people are feeling that in their bones and responding to it. So it makes sense that people should be moving out of cash on a long-term basis. It makes sense.
And given your style of investing, which focuses on the PEG ratio, which often uses future growth rates based on a year or 5 years going forward, does the withdrawal of forecasts or any forward guidance make the analysis more difficult? How are you handling it?
Yeah, look, COVID has made a lot of things more difficult. And that is one area where that's the case. So I would say it's slightly analogous to 2008 in this respect, in that, but 2008 was less dramatic in this respect, but it's analogous. So what we'd ideally like to find in a company is a nice track record of historic earnings growth trending upwards, and then forecasts which suggest that's going to continue. Then we do our work, we get comfortable that those forecasts are either right or wrong, but we form our own view about those numbers, and life is simple. That's how things used to be. In 08, that changed. In 2008, an awful lot of very good companies were not able to deliver growth in 2008. And we took the view then that that was understandable, and that it didn't automatically mean that that company was a bad company, but that they had a blip in that year. And we're taking the same view with COVID. The fact that a company may or may not be affected, the fact a company isn't affected is interesting, but that by itself isn't enough, in my view. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a brilliant business, but it's certainly interesting. But the fact that a company is badly affected for a year doesn't mean it's a bad business. So, but it's harder because there's a lot more, because companies are withdrawing forecasts, so they're making it more difficult. Obviously, they're talking to investors and they set out different scenarios, which they do very publicly. And one can look through those and see what that might mean. But there's the risk of a kind of longer hiatus with COVID-19 for some companies, which complicates things. But it's also an opportunity. You know, complexity is normally a good thing as long as one's prepared to do the work. So it does complicate things. Our preference historically has always been to buy businesses that have great record, great outlook, and they're trading their socks off right now. And we can't find all of those ingredients with everything we look at.
And does focus on the PEG ratio mean you wouldn't invest in a loss-making company, even if it's fast growth, it's got a moat, it's got cash generation, but it's reinvesting all of that cash back into the business, so it's not generating a positive cash flow? Would you look at something like that?
It's a question of degree. So what we wouldn't want to look at is a business that loses money and that all of the valuation is based on the hope that they'll massively increase sales and that will lead to a wonderful hockey stick in profitability. We're not interested in that sort of thing. Peter Lynch used to say with drug companies, he'd say, I'd much rather pay twice the price once they found something. Now, today, you probably have to pay 10 times the price. So it may not be a perfect analogy, but we're not interested in companies that haven't got whatever it is one's backing. We want to see it. We want to see it's actually there. So very early stage businesses, we've got no interest in whatsoever. If it's a more mature business and they're choosing not to kind of show a profit, or not to show all of the profit they could show, that's slightly different. And that is, again, a more complex analysis. But, the likes of the Blue Prisms, those sorts of things, I would say they're more at the earlier stage than that. Maybe now they're slightly more advanced. But when that came to market, it's done very well. But we didn't spend any time looking at it, really, because it clearly wasn't going to make money for a long time. And it was clearly an awful lot of things had to happen in the future. And philosophically, we're prepared to just not make money on certain things, even if we think they're interesting, if they don't fit our process, because some of them work and some of them really don't work. And I would say in the UK particularly, less so in America, but in the UK, the record of companies that don't yet make a profit in the public market is awful. So, the average investor investing in IPOs would be far better off never to invest in an IPO, irrespective of the type of IPO. But a lot of that is because of these pre-profit things that drag down the averages. The other thing is IPOs are always very pricey to start with because it's being sold at a time of the vendor's choosing. And you see the same in AIM. You know, the reason AIM has underperformed so badly since it started in 1999, and it's something like the underperformance against companies of a similar size on the full list, it's something like 9% compound since 1999. So it's a massive underperformance. The index is down since it started, which was an awfully long time ago. The reason for that is that it's got this preponderance of concept stocks which don't make money. And, you know, they're very, you get the odd one that works, but there aren't enough of those. So philosophically, I'm really happy to accept that we're going to miss the odd thing, but the trade-off is we're taking a lot less risk.
So you've got a checklist that filters 95% of companies based on growth, the PEG ratio, cash flow generation. And then for the remaining 5% that leaves, you screen for qualitative factors. What's the most important criteria of those qualitative factors?
I would say in screening terms, there are one or two things you can do, you can screen for, which are fairly objective. So things like return on capital, it's an incredibly important measure. It tells you an awful lot about the quality of a business. So that's something we can screen for at that once we've done the initial filtering. Margins, and particularly the level of margins and trends in margins, again, tells you a lot about the quality of a business. But beyond that, I would say it's highly subjective. You know, it's a bit like, well, I think there was that US senator who said, you know, the definition of pornography is very hard to pin down, but you know it when you see it. And I think a good business is similar. Sometimes you find a business and you just know it's a good business. It almost leaps off the page. And that can be from all sorts of different areas. It can be triggered by lots of things, but in essence, we like businesses where we can extrapolate growth as far out into the future as possible. So what that means is that there's something there that's identifiable that gives that business some sort of tailwind. But that can come from lots of different areas. So, you know, obviously an important thing for us is that a business is in a broad area that's doing well and likely to continue to do well. We want the competitive landscape in that sector to be benign. There are some industries where that simply doesn't apply. So you can whittle things down quite quickly. But then it's about what is it that's going to drive the growth? And that can be lots of different things. It can be legislation sometimes. It can be brands that a business might own. It can be any number of things, really. Certain trends, you know, when we started out, one of the easiest ways to make money was investing in the restaurant space. And you almost couldn't lose money because people at the time were spending a relatively small part of their disposable income on eating out. And there's been a seismic change in behavior where people were prioritizing their time and they were happy to spend money to go and eat out at a restaurant. And then you had this growth of this middle market, sort of all these middle market chains, the Pizza Expresses and all of these things, which hadn't existed before, really. So they weren't fancy restaurants, but they were better than a sort of greasy spoon. And and there was massive demand for those. And we basically rode that secular trend. And all of those companies were riding that secular trend. And, you know, and the data behind that was actually very forecastable because it had already happened in America. We were running about 10 years behind the Americans. A very similar thing happened with gyms. So around 1998-99, we began investing in gyms. There were a handful on the public markets. And at the time, the average American consumer spent, I think, 10% of their income. No, so that's the wrong way around. No, there were 10% of Americans at the time who were members of gyms. And in England, it was 2%. Something like that. It was as night follows day, that 2% was going to become 10. And it was obvious. So you had a massive tailwind behind that sector. So sometimes it can be an industry tailwind, and then you just got to check that the company you're looking at is a sensible player in the industry. Sometimes it's a very company specific thing. It really varies, but we need that tailwind. The more of that we can find, the happier we are.
And have you found a gym type trend recently? Is it illustrated by any of your holdings?
Well, I mean, I think there's a clear trend. One area we've always loved is content in all its forms. So one area we've done well in as a firm over many, many years has been children's content. Because children's content, you don't get the fashion risk you do with other forms of content. It's very predictable. We were the biggest institutional investor in Thomas the Tank Engine, in Bob the Builder, in Mr. Men, Peppa Pig. We were one of their top investors, and it's an area it's an easy way to make money if you find it a half decent business in that space. At the moment, we've got quite a big investment in. Well, I think we're the biggest investor actually in Codemasters, which is it's a gaming company, and they focus entirely on driving games. They only do driving. And many, many years ago, the company did many more things and they got into trouble. So they decided just to focus on driving, which they've been doing for a while. They're a very good management team. They own the Formula One rights. They own the rights to the Fast and Furious franchise, quite a number of other franchises as well. And that is a... Now, driving particularly, you don't get mega hits with driving games in the same way you do with sort of shooting games. But there is a very strong trend there toward where there are more and more and more people who are taking up gaming. Now, that was obviously happening during the lockdown because people had time on their hands, but that's not why we own the company. We owned it before. But what we do see is with the growth of streaming, over a long period of time, I think you'll add a zero to the number of people who are actually playing games. So there's a massive expansion in that market over the next 10, 15 years, maybe 20 years. But, and we're exposed to that through a very well-managed business. It's cheaper than all the other companies in its space. And the reality is if Google, when they launched their streaming service, you can't launch a service like that without what they call a AAA driving game, which means a high quality driving game. And they went to Codemasters to get that from them for their launch. So they're very well positioned to ride that wave. So I would say today that's one very obvious theme. Now, the problem with obvious themes is that very often things can become very expensive. So you do now find gaming companies on multiples in the 30s and 40s, which doesn't appeal to us.
And you place a strong emphasis on director purchases or sales. Do you place more emphasis on a director buying or a director selling? And does it influence your investing decision? Would you get out or buy into a company because of that?
I think with buying, it's only interesting if the quantities are significant and ideally if you've got a cluster of directors buying at the same time. If it's one director buying, not so interesting, but unless it's big numbers. If they're selling, and also with buying, depending on the numbers, you get a lot of token purchases. And nowadays, a lot of boards say to chief executives, you've got to own a certain proportion of your salary in shares. And so they're not necessarily doing it because they really want to, some of the time. If they're selling, they're only selling for one reason, which is that they want to. Now, in brokers speak, you quite often hear this term that to satisfy institutional demand. But in my experience being on public company boards, I have only ever sold when I've wanted to, not because a broker's asked me nicely. selling, I think, is for one reason normally, and often it's to meet a tax bill or to fund a house or a divorce. You often hear these things, although I think some directors seem to get divorced every 10 minutes. I think selling is, I think cluster buying is very meaningful. I think selling always gets my attention. And particularly if it's heavy, then it's off-putting. Quite often it's the finance director who can be most telling, because they're normally cautious. So when they buy, you know, that sometimes is more meaningful than it might be with the chief executive. But equally, if they're selling a large proportion of their holding, that would get my attention as well. And I would say talking about finance directors selling, if that finance director is working for a software-related company, historically, that's always been a very dangerous sign. And that's mainly because with software, it's less the case these days, but with software, there was always a lot more scope for accounting jiggery-pokery. So finance directors, they're worth keeping an eye on.
And shorting attacks have increased, and Future Publishing were hit by Shadowfall's report at the end of January, which wasn't as impactful as the COVID-19 effect. But at the time, what did you think of the report, and how do you as a fund manager react to an attack on one of your holdings and the negative sentiment that that creates?
I mean, I think in general, shorting is, you know, it's legal. There are academic studies around the degree to which they add to market liquidity, and I think they probably do. I think it's marginal, but I think they probably do. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se. You know, I've done it myself. You know, I don't think it's a terrible thing. I think you do get at certain times, less so now, but I've seen it at various points in markets. When markets are fragile, you quite often find much more cynical forms of short selling, where someone will take a short position and then sort of shout fire, you know, as like someone might do in a crowded cinema or something. And of course, people are going to run for the exit. And if market sentiment's fragile, you get people who game that, and that's more market manipulation, I would say. In the case of the note on Future, I mean, obviously, when something like that comes out, we read it. And that one was incredibly long, but the fact that it was long doesn't mean it was good, because it missed two important points. One key thing for me is, does a company generate cash? Because that, if it does, it deals with almost all the concerns you can really have around accounting. And when companies are acquisitive, and Future has been acquisitive, that's something you've got to pay attention to. But Future generates stacks of cash. And it was interesting to me that most bear notes of that type will try and argue that the accounting's aggressive. And they can't argue that if they don't focus on cash. And there wasn't one reference to cash flow in that 70-page note. And the other thing that I think is important is with acquisitive companies, one is right to be skeptical about companies that are more acquisitive. Future isn't wildly acquisitive, but it's more acquisitive than most. And one has to pay attention to acquisitive companies and think about them more carefully, because there is scope for manipulating data. Earnings per share, for instance, can easily be manipulated. They can be manipulated without making acquisitions, but they can also make it easier with acquisitions. But the key issue with Future is that they extract value from acquisitions that others are not able to extract. And that's a hugely meaningful thing. So it's not just a financial engineering game where they issue shares on a higher multiple than what they're paying for the acquisition. It's that they're actually extracting value that others cannot extract. And if a company can do that, then it deserves a very different designation. You know, in the States, platform businesses, that's a designation people get very excited about. And you've got different types of platforms. But I would argue that a company can extract extra value is a sort of platform business of a kind, and that's worth something. So Future's ability to extract additional value and its cash flows were completely ignored in that note. And we looked at it, and I honestly don't think there was anything in it at all. There was nothing material in there.
And I've heard you talk about exceptional companies in your funds, which you treat differently to good companies. Over your history of managing money, do you find that companies have a life cycle, say going from good to exceptional? And then, for example, if they get very large, they then go from exceptional to good and maybe even bad?
I think in essence, it's the bigger the company is, the more difficult it is to grow very fast. That I think that's just the law of, you know, that's how arithmetic seems to work when it comes to business. Now, a handful of companies in the States recently have slightly disproved this theory, but I would say, absent, you know, the Microsofts and the Amazons of this world, for ever since I've been involved in investment, it's very rare you find a very big company that's generating high levels of growth. So growth rates do tend to come down as companies get bigger, and I think that's why small and medium sized companies offer the best, in normal circumstances, they offer the best prospects of high levels of growth. But in terms of exceptional companies, my point there really is around, if you're a growth investor, the way things tend to work is that what you're looking for is a company that can compound your wealth. And a lot of the companies we end up owning do that to different degrees. But there are some that are just better, and they're very rare, and they're able to grow faster. They have much more runway. They're much more special. And it's incredibly important to identify those companies and treat them differently. So that's really my point around that. So everything we buy, we believe is good or very good at least. So we're already pretty happy. But you have always a handful of companies that are just that little bit better than that. And as a growth investor, you've got to make that distinction. And the reason you've got to make that distinction is you've got to maximize those exceptional companies, which means you've got to give them more rope to run. You've got to allow that re-rating process to happen for longer. You've got to be much more reluctant to sell. That doesn't mean you don't sell, but whereas with a good business or a very good business, you might sell them when they become fairly priced or fully priced. With an exceptional company, you would probably just sell a bit at that stage, because normally the company's improving. You'll find there are upgrades, things are getting better. And the worst thing that can happen if you're too trigger happy is you end up selling and then you want to buy them back in a year or two. And that creates a whole new level of challenges. You know, sometimes it's difficult psychologically, that's one thing, but also sometimes you can't get the shares in the quantities you want. So our view is, you know, if you've got to very consciously make that distinction.
Now, I've got lots more questions, but so have lots of people here. So I'm going to move over to the questions that we've got piling up. Charles Riley asks, does Mark see any further escalation on China trade wars from the US? And how might this impact UK-China relations, and in particular, Venture Life and Strix?
I think that the tensions with China will only get worse. I think we've been in a sort of new Cold War for a period, and it's getting colder. I think that's pretty clearly the direction of travel. And I don't think whoever wins in America in November, I don't think it will change that direction of travel. So I think it's going to get worse. I think the good news is that both us and the Chinese want to continue to do business, but there will be some collateral damage, I'm sure of that. In relation to Venture and Strix, they both operate in China, so there is some risk. I think in the case of Venture, the risk is relatively low. I mean, they do they announced recently a very large order, a 15-year order from a big Chinese company. And it's only very recently in the last few weeks that that's now in some of the forecasts. It's only in the forecast for a year or so. It's not really, people don't really fully, haven't fully trusted those the size of that contract. So I think the risk is manageable there, even if that contract were to evaporate. In the case of Strix, it's more of a manufacturing issue. I mean, they sell a lot into China, but they also manufacture in China. So again, there's risk there. But they're quite a long way down the food chain, I think, in terms of being an obvious target for one side or the other. So, you know, but when these things happen, trade wars and things, you know, there will be collateral damage.
And Mark Atkinson asks, Tesco is shown as a top 10 holding in the Slater Growth, Income and Recovery Funds. What characteristics make it a suitable holding across the portfolio of funds, and what makes Tesco's investment case so compelling?
We bought Tesco's towards the end of last year. So we bought it before they announced the sale of their business in Thailand. And the Thai business is one of the key growth drivers in the business. So the shape of the business has changed a fair bit. But what we were interested in really was that the business is generating decent sort of double-digit style growth, which is unusual for a large company. The multiple's low. It generates a lot of cash, which we like a lot. And I think the most important thing for us is the way in which the business has managed has been completely repurposed so that they're no longer obsessed by like-for-like sales growth at the expense of everything else. They're much more focused on getting the mix right, maximizing profits on the sales that they have. So for us, it's a sort of relatively low risk, high growth company. It's high growth in the context of large caps that generates a lot of cash. The free cash flow yield on this business is extraordinary. So it's a sleep at night, steady growth business.
And Stephen Marcus asks, you mentioned that you look to make 50 to 100% on companies you buy, which implies a tendency towards smaller companies or perhaps recovery plays. How do you decide when to sell, given that growth and rate of gain eventually tail off?
We're not interested in recovery plays. So we're, I mean, when I was talking about aiming for sort of 50 to 100% over 3 to 5 years. That is what we're looking at. I guess my point is what we're not interested in is making a quick 10%. We have no interest in a situation of that kind. When we look at a business, we're looking to benefit from the growth in earnings over a period of time and a re-rating in the multiple. And when both those things happen, there's normally a very significant upside. Now, some businesses are able to sustain growth for a much longer period than others. So that, and that's where you get into this distinction between the very good or the good and the exceptional. The exceptional companies can maintain a high level of growth for a surprisingly long period of time. And then there's a whole lot of degrees thereafter. A lot of the businesses we own for a long time. So a lot of our holdings we've owned for 10 years, quite a number now. A lot of others we've owned for more than 5 years. So we're not looking to get in and out of companies. Our expectation going in is to own a business at least for 3 or 4 years. That's what we're expecting, because that's long enough to see some benefit from growth and a re-rating. But if a company becomes fully priced faster than that, and you know we're not, as it's not a remarkable business, it's just a very good business, and if it all happens in 6 months, we might move on. But it normally doesn't work that way. These things normally play out over time. So, but we're not interested in recovery. This is all about growth. But of course, if if growth prospects diminish, we're much less interested. So we have to look at a business as it is all the time. We have our views today. We have to look at things tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And you keep doing that for years. That never stops because businesses are organic. They're alive. They're changing every day. So you have to be looking at them as they are. And normally with a growth business, that means you hold them for longer. Because you have a price target in mind and a sort of matrix for assessing price at the beginning. But after a year or two, it may well be your view of the company has changed. It may be that you think the growth will continue for longer. So you can often end up holding businesses for longer than you originally expected. But equally, if the facts change, you've got to move on.
So we've got two questions about Hutchinson China Meditech. Alan Reeder asks, I'm with you on the growth fund and note that HZM seems to be a favourite, which has been in the portfolio for a long time. But is it making good progress? Can you tell us a bit about the company from your perspective? And somebody else has said much the same thing, Nicholas Monteith.
I still think it's a very interesting business. We bought the shares in the beginning of 2010, I think it was. We bought about 7.5% of the company in one go. And at the time, it was very, very cheap. This was, just going back to what we were talking about earlier, this was a complex analysis at the time. The business had a clear, the two key elements to it. It had a loss-making development business, drug development business, and it had a very profitable drug business selling mature drugs. And the loss maker was offsetting the profits from the other side. So the company reported a headline loss, which is normally not interesting to us. But we look beyond that and we found that you had these two very different parts of the business. And our analysis at the time was that if we assume that the loss-making entity could be self-financed, and that was the intention of management, and they actually raised external capital into the loss-making business to finance it. So we regarded that as ring-fenced. On that basis, we were buying the very fast-growing, profitable business with a fantastic track record for about 11 or 12 times after-tax earnings. So very, very cheap. You know, drug companies at the time in China were going for 30 times earnings. So it was ludicrously cheap. And it was growing at 20% per annum. So it's a peg of 0.6. And our assumption was that at that stage, that's what we were buying. The development business was interesting, but it was a free option on Blue Sky. We also had lots of cash and we had lots of surplus property as well, which were free options. Now, since then, the property has turned out to be worth a multiple of the value of the business in 2010. The cash is there too, which is nice to have. The loss-making part of the business has now developed to the point where it's still loss-making because it's a development business, but they've now got one, they've got the first novel oncology drug ever developed in China, authorized for the Chinese market. That's now being sold as of last November. They've got a second drug that's going to join it very imminently. They've got multiple phase three trials all over the world now for other drugs. And it's this development business has become a very important part of the valuation. Now that caused us a problem because because we're much more comfortable focusing on earnings. Now we then had to deal with the challenge of, okay, we wouldn't necessarily buy it today, because coming at it cold, because the earnings aren't sufficiently significant in relation to the valuation of the company. But we've had for some years a very, very big information advantage. We were the only institutional investor for a very long time. We really knew the business very, very well, and it was ridiculously underpriced. So we took the view that we would run it to a point where we felt that it was beginning to be reflected in the valuation, and then we would start to sell slowly. So that's what we've done. So we sold quite a lot of shares when they were much higher than current levels a year or two ago. But we've no interest in selling at these levels. I think this year will be very interesting. The company's got its results, I think, on the 1st of August for the first half. But the big news coming relates to Tagrisso. Tagrisso is the sort of wonder drug. It's an oncology drug from AstraZeneca, and it's one of the most impressive oncology drugs on the market at the moment, in that it actually works. The trial results are stunning. And one of Hutchinson's drugs, a drug called savolitinib, is partnered in combination with that drug in trials. And it looks like they've announced data on this already, that the combination works very well. My view is that Hutchinson will be able to piggyback the success of Tagrisso in combination with this other drug of theirs, which will be very significant in financial terms. And they'll be announcing more information around that quite soon, I think. But there's a lot happening with the business now. It's really grown up in the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years. It's a very impressive company. It's listed now on NASDAQ. There's a slight wrinkle around that with the Americans are threatening that Chinese companies listed in NASDAQ may have to lose their listings. And it's unclear, this situation at the moment. But Hutchinson will retain its UK listing. I think if they're forced to, they'd have a Hong Kong listing to replace the American listing, if they were forced to do that, if the rules change. But so that is possibly in people's minds a bit at the moment. But I'm super keen. I think that the shares are very underpriced, given all the progress in the last year or so.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. We've got lots more questions, but we've run out of time. So, Mark, where can people find you or learn more about your funds?
We have a website, which is www.slaterinvestments.com. A lot of information is there. And there are contact details there as well, if people want to ring the office and find out more that way, if they don't like using them, navigating websites. So that's probably the best place to do it. But our funds are also on Googleable. Slater Growth is our largest fund, and that's easy to find. We're on all the platforms.
Mark, many thanks for a superb webinar. If you want an email notification of webinars or events PI World are organising, go to the right-hand side of the homepage at piworld.co.uk. There are two boxes. The top, sign up for notification of a new video as it's published, and underneath, sign up for events. Different lists, no spam. And please do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter, bulletin boards and YouTube. We produce all these videos as a podcast, so do write reviews for the podcast on iTunes. We'd like to go on providing these free webinars, and getting really good speakers like Mark relies on you and the audience numbers we attract. So if you have ideas of speakers, do email or message me. You can find me through the contact page at piworld.co.uk, or do follow me on Twitter at @TamsinPIWorld. Many thanks to you all for joining us, and stay well, and thank you to Mark. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.